In the coming week, Rwanda marks 30 years since its genocide. The White House hosts leaders from Japan and the Philippines. And the Eurovision Song Contest marks 50 years since ABBA's big moment. It's April 4th, 2024, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Carlyn Robbins. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you.
Did you have a fun time?
I did. Thank you very much. Cold Easter break, but it was nice.
Well, this is quite a transition here then. So let's start in Rwanda. On Sunday, April 7th, the country is going to commemorate the 30-year anniversary of the ethnic genocide against the Tutsi population. In over 100 days, a radical extremist faction of Hutus killed 800,000 Rwandans. The United States, France, the UN Security Council all failed horribly. And in a video to be released this Sunday, President Emmanuel Macron of France says that France, which could have stopped the genocide with its Western and African allies, lacked the will to do so. Rwanda these days has a really complicated standing in the world, and its president, Paul Kagame, has been called the West's favorite autocrat. How should we be feeling about this anniversary, and how should we be feeling about our relationship with Rwanda?
Well, as you had set up, Carla, complicated doesn't begin to say what the relationship's like, but it has to certainly be pegged back to the moment of the genocide. And it's worth noting that the genocide didn't pop up out of nowhere. There were ample warnings. The UN had a number of tripwire warnings that came out months and months ahead of what happened, basically warning of the powder keg between the Hutus and the minority Tutsis. And then when the killing started, and actually ahead of the killing, there were UN peacekeeping officials who were saying, you know, a certain number of peacekeepers could prevent slaughter. They were not promised. We should also remember this occurred after, not too long after the horrible Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia, where U.S.-led peacekeepers, among others, got embroiled in a deadly conflict there. That certainly colored it, but it certainly doesn't dismiss what then happened, which was a real failure of the Security Council to act when it could have and when it was warned about it. I would recommend people, if they want to get a sense of how this was building and what was happening, there's a devastating Frontline documentary about that, including capturing on the scene. They had camera crews were on the scene as Western peacekeepers and diplomats were coming to Rwanda, and there were Tutsis there sort of begging them to take them with them. And it's really tough to watch. But it was fast, it was brutal, and it was ended by Paul Kagame's RPF forces and his movement that took over the country and to this day run the country as a single movement, a single individual. Kagame is part of this complicated relationship. He has undoubtedly put the country back on its feet, ended the ethnic tensions while still installing a leadership that is accused of favoring Tutsis, the minority Tutsis, and has gotten involved in supporting a movement, armed movement in Eastern Congo that is said to be, you know, contributing to expanding bloodshed there. But at the same time, in Rwanda itself, he has improved the country's economic stability, its living standards. Its life expectancy has gone up from something like 49, 30 years ago to 66 now. It has had, over the last several decades, 8% growth on an annual basis. And as you say, it got this reputation of leading the Singapore of the Lake District of Africa, as some people have termed it, while being autocratic in the process. He is, by most accounts, going to be a leader for life. There are elections this summer that he is supposed to win handily. And as The Economist noted in its inimitable way in a recent article, in the land of 1,000 hills, only one man can have the moral high ground, and that is Paul Kagame. So this is the situation. This is the legacy today. And it is a country that continues to get a good deal of aid and, by many accounts, uses it well because of the guilt that has arisen from the episode 30 years ago. And for some more helpful background and context about Rwanda's path of the last 30 years, I commend our colleague Mariel Ferragamo's piece that we put up on CFR.org this week, looking at the country's path.
Rwanda's also been in the news because of Kagame's willingness to participate in this completely morally weird deal that is yet to go through with the Brits, taking in migrants. And this, I think he cut this originally with Boris Johnson. And the moral ambivalence of these relationships is so odd. Is it based on the guilt of the West that he gets such an enormous pass, or is he playing a useful role for countries?
I think it's a combination, certainly. I mean, as was pointed out in the Economist article I mentioned in other places, Kagame has been very skillful as using Rwanda's leverage diplomatically, whether it's working on a deal to take asylum seekers with the UK. By the way, he had signed a deal a few years earlier with Denmark to do the same thing. He set up an asylum center in the capital, Kigali. He has maintained relations with Russia while at the same time being seen as a counterpoint to the Russian attempts to be an influential security broker in Africa. Rwanda itself plays a role in exporting peacekeeping into other countries in Africa, for example. He has maintained relationship with China. China has built a lot of infrastructure in Rwanda while also keeping China at arm's length, and is able to be accepted in Western capitals to this day, despite policies that have, you know, earned him some rebuke, especially probably more so from the U.S. than some of the European capitals. But you can't get past the heavy guilt that a lot of these countries feel for what was allowed to happen in 1994, in the spring of 1994. Again, as I say, at a time when Africa is dealing with the backlash against democracy or backsliding of democracy, and it's dealing with an encroachment of Russian forces, the Wagner Group and so forth, and it's dealing with other problems, climate-driven, and look what's going on in Sudan now and so forth. Rwanda is this place of relative stability, but it's also exporting instability in terms of what it's doing in Eastern Congo. So again, very complicated relationship. It's somebody who has to be dealt with and has to be, I think, engaged by countries in the West, but also not fully, obviously, embraced.
Madeleine Albright used to say this was her greatest regret, the failure in Rwanda. So there is that profound guilt. So when you hear Macron talk about it, it is quite compelling. But at the same time, in its 2024 report, Freedom House says that the country has rates Rwanda's not free, says that, you know, they suppress political dissent, pervasive surveillance, intimidation, arbitrary detention. It's really terrible when you see the heroes fall. Bob, let's move to Washington. Next Wednesday kicks off back-to-back White House summits. First, an official state visit for Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, followed by a trilateral summit joined by Philippines President Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. And there's a lot going on with these visits. There's going to be a new security pact between Japan and the U.S., and then, of course, this first ever summit between the three leaders. What are you going to be looking for in these meetings?
It's going to be very interesting to see that the meetings in which certainly the concern about China is permeating, how much they openly say that versus how much they use other language to kind of maybe just make it a reference as opposed to an explicit either condemnation or warning sign or whatever. And I say that partly because we started off the week with a what was reported to be a two-hour call between President Biden and Xi Jinping, where they were supposedly having an ongoing, frank, productive exchange, according to some of the readouts from both sides. And you have Janet Yellen putting in a pretty long visit to China as we went to tape this podcast, raising concerns about Chinese, among other things, flooding of various tech products, including solar panels on Western markets in the U.S. But at the same time, a real desire by the U.S. to maintain dialogue and not to overly antagonize China, keep the lines of dialogue open. But make no mistake, this meeting, this trilateral summit, is about trying to project calm and security in this part of the world where there's been remarkable sort of advance in a security web, where Japan is an important part of this. And, you know, I should just note, our colleague Sheila Smith has been tracking this for years since Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe revised the constitution to open up its defense policies a bit more and its ability to exercise defense in a projection way. Japan is now, you know, openly engaging with the Philippines and working to get involved in exercises and in training Filipino forces. And it had a trilateral summit last summer with South Korea. That was a really big deal because Japan and South Korea have had a really rough relationship for decades, stemming from World War II era atrocities by Japanese forces. And so we're in a moment where, you know, Japan is taking on a new role. Philippines under Marcos has somewhat surprisingly, you know, come to the U.S. much more quickly than had been expected at following the Duterte era of leadership in Philippines. And we're in a time when China has been ramping up its assertions of sovereignty in the South China Sea, But also, you know, vis-a-vis Taiwan, it's got disputes with Japan over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And so all of that is a backdrop to really important security discussions between the three, and then economic as well. There's going to be some important economic overtones coming out of these talks, both bilaterally and trilaterally. So I think what's called the U.S.-Philippines-Japan triad is going to be something that is going to be bearing a closer watch as they potentially enter into more binding agreements.
Two things, I suppose, about Japan. One is how much of this is a Trump effect versus just sort of a natural evolution reaction to China, North Korea. I mean, every time the North Koreans test another missile and it tumbles close to Japan, they have pretty good reason to be nervous. But it's also, they've got this constitution that bans them from possessing any war potential with this Article 9. How close to the edge are they coming to violating their own Article 9? I mean, with all these purchases they're planning on making and this closer and closer security relationship with the U.S.
I think they're very carefully, you know, walking up to that line by most accounts. And let's just talk about some of that spending. For example, they have a plan in place to increase security capabilities by something like $320 billion, which would raise defense spending to 2% of GDP over 5 years. That's the level of what NATO countries have committed to holding, and that only maybe a third of them have done so. And Japan is saying it will do that over 5 years. And this is for things like Tomahawk cruise missiles and F-35 fighter jets.
Actually, NATO's saying that they're going to be half.
Oh, is it going to be half? Okay. In any event, Japan is already jumping into this as a non-NATO member, but as a sign of its willingness to, you know, get involved in this alliance of the East Asian countries and working more closely with the U.S. And apropos your question, you know, basically, if a Trump administration part two comes into office, presenting to them the fact that they are a reliable ally, and that these are ties that are worth cultivating, continuing, and strengthening. It's worth noting that under the first Trump administration, Japan rather skillfully handled that relationship. It was one of the first visits I think Trump had was with Shinzo Abe. And so we should definitely take that into consideration. I think every country, every U.S. ally certainly is weighing those calculations as, you know, we prepare in the U.S. for the Biden-Trump part two. And so, you know, that's definitely a backdrop. Trump administration is, you know, certainly not willing to sort of open the door to China. It had laid out some markers against China. It had set in force some alliance, Indo-Pacific alliance activities as well. So that's also worth considering. But I think it's all a backdrop to where things are going. You're right to note the North Korean threat. North Korea has, if anything, just ramped up its provocations, its testing. It's testing of missiles that come really close to Japanese territory and waters or over Japanese territory. And so it's just survival mode. And I think the North Korean part in particular is something that gives the Japanese more and more confidence that they can continue to adjust their constitution to meet the moment. Carl, I'm going to take us in a completely different direction and talk about Waterloo and not the famous battle of 200 years ago. Oh, no. We're talking about ABBA. Let's go to Sweden. Saturday marks 50 years since the band ABBA performed the famous Waterloo song at the Eurovision Song Contest and won. That song, I think most people just hearing it of almost any generation, they'll immediately go to the earworm chorus. But ABBA's 1974 performance was a catalyst that brought this group instant global fame. They did not rest on their laurels, and they were by no account a one-hit wonder. So as our resident ABBA fan, why this has such staying power? Why is this Eurovision moment living on?
I mean, this is just, I mean, it's just, it's great music. It's, I mean, let me start again. is it great music? There's very little about the 1970s aesthetic that I remember fondly, Bob. But the kitschiness, the singability, it's just an enormous amount of fun, ABBA. And it's probably my favorite thing about an era of, my God, the clothes, the haircuts, everything else was so grim. And just ABBA is, you know, just an enormous amount of fun. And Waterloo is a truly great song. And this year's celebration of ABBA's breakout win is really becoming just an incredibly massive thing. The Brits, in particular, like to claim at least partial ownership for ABBA since the big win took place in Brighton, and the band lived there for a while. And BBC Two is celebrating the anniversary with a dedicated night of ABBA programming, including a new documentary, When ABBA Came to Britain. They're ours. We claim them. The city of Brighton never missing an opportunity to invite tourists, has a four-day celebration, four, count them, days, planned with ABBA shows, bus rides, painting sessions, an exhibition of the Bright Museum and Art Gallery. And at the venue where the big Eurovision win took place, there's going to be another Eurovision winner, Charlotte, and what they describe as Eurovision royalty will be performing ABBA's greatest hits, backed up, and I really wish I could go see, by the famous Brighton Gay Men's Chorus. So this is going to be a major celebration. And it should be noted that Sweden won the honor of hosting this year's Eurovision in May, and they're expected to go all in on ABBA. And under the contest rules, the countries whose singer wins the previous year gets to host this year. And when its singer, Loreen, or I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, it could be Lauren, we'll have to look that up, won last year's competition, it sparked an online conspiracy that the system had been totally rigged so that the contest could be held in ABBA's home field for the anniversary. That's how much attention Eurovision gets and how much attention ABBA itself gets. Finally, it also needs to be noted that ABBA made very clear that they are not going to be performing at Eurovision this year. The last time they played together was on the BBC in 1982, which is a very long time ago.
Wow.
But there are still hopes that their holographic avatars, which are called, Bob, can you guess?
No.
Avatars.
Of course.
And there's hope that the avatars are going to be able to show up. And they have been playing at this specially created arena in London. More than 1.6 million people have gone to see them. And these are digital recreations based on the real band members who've been filmed in motion capture suits. And people pay an enormous amount of money in London to go see them. Whether or not they can actually transfer the technology to Malmö, Sweden, we're not clear on yet. But stay tuned for what is going to be an enormous celebration of Waterloo and the ABBA phenom.
So, Carla, Eurovision launched then ABBA in many ways, but I would think that ABBA's success might have been a boost for Eurovision itself. I mean, this is a contest that still mystifies many Americans, but anybody who's been to Europe for any amount of time, it's a big deal and it has remained a big deal. Is that the case, or was Eurovision, you know, too big to even get a boost by ABBA?
Well, I don't know. I think you talk to Europeans, they're really devoted to Eurovision. And the way it works is that it started back in 1956. And it is this joint effort by the European Broadcasting Union, which calls itself an alliance of public service media organizations. And each country has its own public broadcaster, which nominates their one candidate. And the rules are, has to be, you know, an original song, can only be for the final only 3 minutes long. And the rules have gone back and forth whether or not it has to be in native language. Of course, Waterloo is in English and not in Swedish. And I, my devotion to the podcast, if you go on YouTube, you can see clips in one particular YouTube clip of every Eurovision winner from 1956 on. And I will say, and I don't mean to sound elitist about this, there's a lot there that I'm not going to be singing along to, I will say. But Celine Dion was a winner. So there have been some. And I think, you know, the rules are, and they've changed somewhat over time, but the rules are basically there's a judges, but there's also people vote. People used to call in. And then, of course, you go on the internet. There's all sorts of ways people, and you can't vote for your own country. And there are all sorts of interesting rules. I think it's much less foreign to Americans than it used to be, because we've got all these other, you know, Simon Cowell and all these other things that now happen. That, and they're also, of course, all transplants from Europe as well. But this is a big thing. And I was at the CFR event in San Francisco, where I am, last night. And I mentioned we were going to be doing this. And two things. One, I mentioned that it was because the anniversary of Waterloo, and a bunch of much younger than us people immediately started humming Waterloo, which is, gives you a sense of the appeal of it. And the other thing is there were a couple of Europeans there who all went, oh my God, Eurovision. So it's clearly, certainly got a big pull to it. And the other winners, I can tell you, Bob, there are a lot of people you've never heard of.
So maybe in ABBA's case, you could say the winner takes it all, but not other winners.
Gimme a break, Bob.
Okay. We'll stop there, but we will post that list that you mentioned on our show notes page, Carla, because I think it's going to be crucial to pore over that for those interested. Carla, we've sung ourselves into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. This is the figure that listeners vote on every Tuesday and Wednesday at CFR_org's Instagram story. This week, Carla, our audience selected opposition Ekrem Imamoglu wins Istanbul. This is the mayorship of Istanbul we're talking about. Why is losing that race bad for Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling party?
It certainly makes Erdogan, who we talk about a lot on the podcast, look a lot less invincible. And one hopes that it could be a good thing for Turkey's battered democracy. We discussed last year how Erdogan used the power of his office, including his control of the media and the budget, to win re-election despite a really devastating earthquake and hugely high inflation. And the expectation this year was that he was going to once again bully his way through these elections as well. And the polls look that way. But instead, the opposition not only won big in Istanbul, and Imamoglu won re-election by 11.5 percentage points over a candidate that Erdogan really went all in for. The opposition Republican People's Party will now run 35 of the country's cities, up from 21, including the top five largest cities: Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, Bursa, and Antalya. So this is a pretty devastating setback for Erdogan, just, you know, less than a year after he won the presidential election. So there's a real message in there. And what makes this loss in particularly hard is that Erdogan made his career as an opposition leader who first came to power as mayor of Istanbul. And adding insult to injury, he did his best to try to thwart the rise of Imamoglu from the start. When Imamoglu ran, you recall, Imamoglu won. He briefly held the mayorship. Erdogan lobbied. He claims he didn't do it, but the election commission, they took Imamoglu out. They re-ran the election, and Imamoglu won a second time. So this is, you know, he's been trying to thwart him. And I think the fact that he manages to win despite Erdogan repeatedly is sending the message, A, that Erdogan is not invincible, and B, that when the elections come around again in 28, he's the logical candidate. Now, Erdogan is term limited. He has said that this was going to be his last election. But the betting is, and it may just be because this is a country that can't imagine itself without the autocrat in power, but it may be that Erdogan will try to figure out another way to stay in power, and we'll see a face-off between Erdogan and Imamoglu. But it's not till 2028.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's something to watch very closely. It's maybe a moment for cautious optimism that it's such a surprising result. The fact that Erdogan allowed the party to run candidates in all these places still points out that there is some, you know, some room for democratic exercising in Turkey, but also shows, I think, that public is pretty much fed up with this economic stewardship. I mean, it's whether it's corruption scandals or just the tinkering in the, you know, the currency, other things, the response to and the preparations for sustaining infrastructure under earthquakes, all those things seem to have added up to a real problem for Erdogan that even some stage managing of elections could not overcome.
Erdogan's a very good politician. The question is whether he has so much power, and these guys, after a while, so lose touch with what's going on around them. I don't know whether he's going to get the message. We'll have to see.
And he's in a very dangerous neighborhood. We've talked about him before as playing a somewhat of a broker role, at least in the initial phases of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And it's obviously Turkey strategically important, a NATO member with a autocratically minded leader at the moment. So a lot at stake and some stirrings of democracy. So let's give it at least two cheers.
And meanwhile, one final note. In December 22, a Turkish court sentenced Imamoglu to 2 years and 7 months in prison. And imposed a political ban for when he insulted public officials in his speech after his June 2019 win. He said, quote, "The ones who canceled the March 31st election, which is the Supreme Election Council, are fools." He appealed the case, and the appeals court hasn't made a decision yet. Could they now retake the case because he's, you know, he's once again humiliated the AK? We'll have to see that as well.
More intrigue as we go into this mega year of elections that we've been talking about almost every week. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Elections continue in South Korea, where legislative elections will be watched closely. Armed groups are expected to leave Tripoli, Libya, after more than a decade of control. And millions around the world mark the end of Ramadan.
Please subscribe to The World next week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. We appreciate the feedback. If you'd like to reach out, please email us at twnw@cfr.org. The publications mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, are listed on the podcast page for The World next week on cfr.org. Please also note that opinions expressed on The World next week are solely those of the host, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Esther Fang and Sineta Deuce, with Director of Podcasting Gabrielle Sierra. And special thanks to our intern Olivia Green for her research assistance. Our theme music is provided by ABBA, by our fabulous Marcus Zacharia. This is Carla Robbins saying so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye and keep on singing.